The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. First up today is an article from the March 31st, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, a critic at large section. We're still not done with Jesus. Scholars debate whether the gospel stories preserve ancient memories or are just Greek literature in disguise. But there's a reason they won't stay dead and buried, by Adam Gopnik. One subject that never dies, and more significantly, never bores, is the life and times of the first century Jesus rabbi and martyr Jesus, whose followers founded a religion in his name, or rather, in honor of his title, Christ, meaning the Anointed One, or Messiah. Not necessarily a divine title, it had previously been associated with military and religious leaders, often indicating something closer to the great than the godlike. Along with Buddha and Muhammad, he is one of the three nameable figures credited with founding religions that have continued to grow over thousands of years. The Princeton professor, Emeritus Elaine Pagels, who has written many imposing and engrossing books on early Christianity, is back with a kind of culminating work, Miracles and Wonder, published by Doubleday, the title slyly looking at both St. Paul and Paul Simon. Though her purposes are manifold, she begins by ably navigating through the shoals of the essential but surprisingly unsettled sources that seem to relate the events of Jesus' life and death. There are, first, the epistles of St. Paul, the late convert who brought the Jewish heresy to the Gentiles, releasing it from Torah observance and law and making it a universal faith. The seven undisputed Pauline letters were written in and around the 50s, about 15 to 20 years after the Passion. Six others are regarded as later, polemical forgeries, correcting Paul's egalitarianism with more gender-bound rules. Then there are the letters, Hebrews and Jude and so on, of uncertain early date and more uncertain authorship. Most important, there are the four Gospels, written in Greek some 40 to 60 years after the crucifixion is thought to have happened. These were composed somewhere far from Jerusalem in a language that Jesus and his disciples would not have known, by writers who could not have been eyewitnesses. The books are attributed, in probable order of composition, to Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, with the attribution provided by the Greek formula of according to, unique to these texts. The suggestion is that these are not accounts by so-and-so, but the story as told to so-and-so. Though fugitive and fragmentary, the events in the Gospels take place on a fixed historical timeline. Judea, the remaining Jewish kingdom, conquered throughout the centuries by Assyrians, Persians, and Greeks, was annexed by the Roman Empire around 6 CE. The story of Jesus' life, if accurately reported, occurred in the brief window between the annexation and the Jewish revolt of the 60s and 70s. That fanatic rebellion, mournfully chronicled by the great Jewish historian Josephus, ended in a catastrophe rivaled in the history of Jews only by the Holocaust. It involved the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, the enslavement and exile of thousands, and the loss of sovereignty over Jewish holy sites. From this desolation arose the messianic faith of Christianity, which, after the conversion of the Emperor Constantine in 312, eventually became the Roman Empire's sole state religion. How Jesus' story fits into this framework is very much Pagel's question. She's working within a tradition of historical Jesus studies that took shape in earnest more than two centuries ago, And for her, the Gospels are palimpsests of lore, legend, and propaganda, beneath which a core of oral transmission and shared recollection remains detectable. The shifting nativity narratives, for instance, suggest that rumors about Jesus' parentage existed from the beginning. Pagels notes that the miraculous birth stories appear relatively late. Paul, who never met Jesus, though he might have met his brother, mentions nothing about a virgin birth. Neither does Mark, who makes Jesus' adoption by God as his son the true beginning of the story, tied to Jesus' baptism by John. In various texts, including apocryphal works that date to around the same time as the Gospels proper, Joseph appears to suspect Mary of infidelity. Meanwhile, an early Jewish polemic claimed that Jesus was the illegitimate son of a Roman soldier nicknamed Panther, perhaps employing a tasteless but pointed pun on the Greek word parthenos, virgin. The story of the virgin birth, Pagels argues, was introduced by Matthew and, in another version, by Luke, in order to address such lingering doubts. The consoling notion of divine impregnation was commonplace in the Hellenistic world, with countless tales of gods foisting demigods on virgins. Plutarch, for instance, described Rome's founder Romulus as born to a divinely impregnated Vestal Virgin, as Catherine Nixey, a writer for The Economist, shows in Heretic, Jesus Christ and the Other Sons of God, published by Mariner, an irreverent reassessment of the Jesus stories in light of similar myths. Early Christians did not merely acknowledge these parallels, but actively traded on them as precedents for their own claims. The second century apologist, Justin Martyr, argued that Christianity's central tenets were no different in kind from the divine births of Zeus's many sons. Though, of course, he insisted that his divine birth story happened to be true. The only real originality in the accounts of Jesus' virgin birth is their distinctly Jewish and prudish tone, with the impregnation dignified and at arm's length, rather than represented, as in the Hellenistic myths, as a shower of gold or the lovemaking of an amorous swan. Pagel's larger point is that the most improbable gospel tales serve to patch a fractured narrative, using familiar tropes and myths to smooth over inconsistencies that believers struggled with from the beginning. We repair the rips in memory's fabric with the filler of fable. And so, within a decade of George Washington's death, his undocumented childhood produced the enduring myth of the chopped-down cherry tree. She concludes with a delicate rereading of the Magnificat, suggesting that Mary's gratitude is not for the child himself, but for the miracle that transforms an illegitimate birth into a blessing, an occasion of shame recast as a song of salvation. Not perhaps an orthodox reading, but one that is persuasive on its own terms. Similarly, the variations in the nativity stories, Matthew features Persian magi, while Luke omits them in favor of local shepherds, are not merely discrepancies of partial memory. Rather, they are instances of purposeful mimesis, shaped by the needs of their authors. For Matthew, a Torah-observant Jewish Christian, the image of Persian magi bowing before the newborn Jesus Messiah is appealing, reinforcing his vision of Jesus as the fulfillment of Jewish prophecy. Luke, by contrast, is intent on reconciling Christianity with Roman rule, or at least demonstrating that this nascent sect poses no threat to the empire. For him, shepherds and stables provide a nicely reassuring pastoral setting. But Persian magi are an unwelcome detail, too foreign, too unruly. Attentive to the mythological roots of these stories, Pagels negotiates between rationalist skepticism and a more romantic appreciation of their moral force. She notes that miraculous cures were common in the ancient world, those attributed to Jesus, described in language nearly identical to accounts of the Greek mystic and holy man Apollonius of Tyana, say, are neither more nor less convincing than others. But she adds a deeper insight. The outlook of Jesus' world made it particularly receptive to psychosomatic illness and its cures. Certainly, this offers powerful support to the scholar John Dominic Crossan's claim that Jesus' originality lay in his commensality, his willingness to touch lepers he could not heal, and to dine with prostitutes he neither patronized nor liberated. His miracles were ecumenical, often involving the untouchable. He may not have cured those he healed, but the act of trying to heal anyone who asked was in itself a kind of miracle. The Passion and the Resurrection are, of course, at the heart of the Jesus story. Pagels suggests that Matthew's account of the empty tomb, followed by ever more elaborate resurrection narrative, serves both to address the practical difficulties of reclaiming the bodies of the executed and to counter skeptical claims that Jesus' corpse had simply been stolen. Stories of resurrection and rebirth, after all, recur throughout history. Bereavement hallucinations, intensely vivid encounters with the deceased, are reported by as many as half of all grieving people. Elvis, for one, was seen by many in the years following his death, with a newspaper report of a sighting in Kalamazoo at least as reliable as the spotty accounts shared by fervent believers 2 millennia ago. And Paul depicts his own explicitly visionary encounters with a long-dead Jesus as equivalent to the earlier encounters reported by the apostles. Pagels rightly but audaciously likens the evolving belief in Jesus' resurrection to that of the followers of the Lubavitcher Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson in our own time. During his life, many devotees of the Brooklyn Rebbe believed he was the Messiah, a conviction that he encouraged without ever explicitly confirming, much like the Jesus of the Gospels. After Schneerson's death in 1994, only a small portion of believers insisted that he remained physically alive, but others continued to experience him as an enduring presence, a guide still available for inner light and intercession, as Jesus was for Paul. In times of catastrophe, such beliefs tend to harden into certainty. If the Lubavitcher community had been struck by something on the scale of the Judeans' loss of the temple and their enslavement, what are now marginal hallucinatory visions of the Rebbe would almost certainly take on a more declarative redemptive form. Long live the Rebbe, King Moshiach forever, the Lubavitcher slogan seen on New York street corners, is, in essence, no different from Christ is risen. Both trace the same arc from comforting spiritual presence to asserted physical reality. The interpretive approach that Pagels represents is skeptical. Nothing happened quite as related, but inclined to accept that something happened, in something like the sequence suggested. A scholarly paradigm that has shown in recent years shifts the focus. The Gospels are now seen as literary constructions from the start. There were no rips in the fabric of memory, in this view, because there were no memories to mend, no foundational oral tradition beneath the narrative, only a lattice of tropes. The Gospel authors, far from being community leaders preserving oral sayings for largely illiterate followers, were highly literate members of a small, erudite upper crust, distant in experience, attitude, and geography from any Galilean peasant preachers. Their writings bear all the marks of that sharp-elbowed circle and none of the gentle gatherings of group memory. Indeed, the Gospels don't even present themselves as history, the way other chronicles of the time did. Whether one considers the collection of early Christian Gospels, the various apostolic acta, the assortment of apocalypses, or the burgeoning stock of hagiographa, Richard C. Miller argues in his 2015 study, Resurrection and Reception in Early Christianity, the reader finds nothing deserving of the genus historiography. The early Christian Gospels show, quote, no visible weighing of sources, no apology for the all-too-common occurrence of the supernatural, no endeavor to distinguish such accounts and conventions from analogous fictive narratives in classical literature, end quote. From this perspective, the familiar elements of the Nativity, the stable, the shepherds, the Magi, were not meant to paper over the embarrassment at Jesus' illegitimacy. Rather, they were simply the stories you told because that's what the birth narratives of demigods were like. The tomb was found empty not because of local confusion or an effort to suppress the fate of a corpse. It was empty because an empty tomb was a standard signifier of divinity. Miller catalogs many comparable instances. The Gospels' portrayals of Jesus, he concludes, offer nothing that couldn't be found within the well-worn conventions of the Mediterranean demigod tradition. Just as 19th century criticism shaped the older paradigm, the new one is deeply informed by postmodern theory, with its skepticism toward foundationalist thought. That is, the new paradigm rejects the idea that there is a base layer of historical fact that writing partially conceals, in a kind of dance of the seven literary veils. All there is beneath those literary veils is more dancing. The most accessible statement of this new paradigm may come from Robin Faith Walsh, a professor at the University of Miami. A pugnacious writer and a charismatic public speaker, Walsh argues in her 2021 book, The Origins of Early Christian Literature, that the Gospels, whatever else they may be, are first and foremost Greek literature. Their closest affinities, she contends, are not with Jewish folklore or communal memory, but with the miraculous novels and excitable bioi of lives that filled the Hellenistic world, stories often centered on wonder workers from a humble social caste. These bioi, picaresque tales of magi, sages, and tricksters, are filled with miracles, dramatic confrontations, and recurring resurrection motifs. Some bioi, for example, highlight the virtues of their subjects, Walsh writes. Others endow their subjects with extraordinary abilities of a different kind, superpowers, if you will, that involve what one might term magic or other sorts of wonder-working. Many of these protagonists also possess a keen wit, outfoxing their opponents with, as she notes, clever riposts and wise sayings, sometimes in the form of parables. Odd as it may seem to subsume the Alexander romance, the life of Aesop, and the Gospels under the same genre, the narratives of Jesus' deeds and sayings can be seen as pertaining to the same biographical tradition. Like Socrates or Aesop, Jesus is at the margins of society, a Judean peasant, powerless in relation to the state. In his encounters with Pharisees or other interlocutors, he wins his victories by means of his wits and his ability to turn the words of his opponents against them. End quote. The habit of taking the Gospels as repositories of a community's oral tradition, Walsh suggests, is an unexamined inheritance from 19th century German Romanticism. Deeply invested in Völkisch memory, German scholars envisioned the Gospel writers as culling and refining oral tradition, much like the brothers Grimm, who collected and transcribed folk tales. Just as the Grimms turned scattered oral traditions into polished literary narratives, so, the theory went, did the Gospel authors. But Walsh argues that no direct evidence supports the idea that the Gospels emerge from such a process. Instead, the Gospels seem to have more in common with the self-consciously crafted storytelling of Hans Christian Andersen, imaginative narrative shaped by skilled authors to fit a particular vision. At the extreme edge of this revisionism is the work of Richard Carrier, whose book On the Historicity of Jesus, published in 2014, forcefully presents the mysticist view, the argument that no historical Jesus ever existed. Carrier contends that early Christianity began as a purely visionary movement worshiping a celestial figure, an angelic being who took on human flesh to be crucified by Satan, buried, and reborn in the sky. Only later, he thinks, did a competing sect within the movement historicize this figure, placing him on earth. Carrier, an independent scholar with a Columbia PhD, is a fascinating public figure. A YouTube intellectual, a term offered without snobbery, who is a regular presence in the energetic ecosystem of the platform's myriad channels, mostly hosted by amateurs and improbably devoted to early Christian history, including Gnostic Informant, Godless Engineer, Myth Vision, and History Valley. His polemical style, often sarcastic and combative, has made him a divisive figure. But his arguments in print are much more measured than his online persona might suggest. He's cogent, for instance, about the so-called Testimonium Flavianum, the interpolated passage in Josephus' history which seems to discuss and extravagantly praise Jesus. Though it is universally recognized to be at least in part Christian embroidery, Carrier offers convincing arguments for joining those who think that it is a forgery in its entirety. Unfortunately, he is one of those figures who, thinking for themselves, also think by themselves, and so he cannot always tell his strongest ideas from his weakest ones. Defending both with sometimes undue aggression inside the ecosystem of videoed disputes. It is moving in a way that texts so ancient and arguments so obscure can continue to flame in an age where textuality and argument seem so remote. Neither Miller nor Walsh would describe themselves as mythicists. Indeed, both keep a wary, if friendly, distance from Carrier. Neither mentions him in their bibliographies, but both have made peaceable references to him in interviews. They could instead be described as postmodernists. Walsh regularly cites Bourdieu, as Miller cites Derrida, who think that asking, did Jesus exist, is naive and off-target, more a question for the History Channel than a question to be channeled through history. Jesus, whether a historical figure or not, exists for us only as a literary character in a series of polemical exchanges. Even if he existed, his actual purposes, whatever they might have been, are marginal to the development of Christianity as a religion. Yet, even after absorbing the suspicions of the new scholars, accepting the empty tomb as a set-piece story, the nativity as a shifting proscenium narrative, one returns to a basic truth. Fables can be entirely fictional and still contain implicit facts. Extravagant narratives often have an empirical core. We make our way back to Pagel's reasonable middle ground, one that acknowledges both the constructed nature of the text and the oddities and frictions that point the way out of pure textuality. Spike Lee's 1992 biopic, Malcolm X, is also a collection of tropes, figures, and familiar cinematic devices, stuffed with quotations, conscious and unconscious, from earlier movies, with direct visual borrowings from Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole, and a long climactic section quoting Stanley Kubrick's Spartacus. That does not mean that there isn't a very real figure being portrayed behind and through these devices. Indeed, the movie is separated from the life of its subject by about the same number of years that separate the Gospels from Jesus' life, and in the same way it refashions Malcolm's life and death to suit the political needs of its day. Lee emerges as Malcolm's mark, intent on diminishing the eccentricity of Malcolm's religious beliefs, no flying saucers or human-making magicians, and in a similarly prudent revisionist spirit, on diverting blame for his assassination from the Nation of Islam, eliminating Louis Farrakhan's probable role in the murder, and instead affixing it to, so to speak, the Romans, the FBI, and the New York police. The film reshapes meanings, filters facts, and crafts a narrative around cinematic conventions. But it does not erase the essential outline of Malcolm's life. It isn't just a movie. The Gospels are certainly Greek literature, yet they may well be Greek literature inspired by an actual Jewish life. Pagels, rehabilitating aspects of Christianity on terms that a secular scholar can respect, revels in the contradictions and the inconsistencies, not as flaws to be explained away, but as signs of the faith's capaciousness. The miracles are miracles simply because they are a source of wonder. Christianity is not one thing or one faith, but countless variants, traditionally at war with one another, but capable of reconciliation, or at least coexistence. Its essential reversal of worldly expectations, captured in Paul's defiant words, "For Christ's sake I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong," introduced a way of thinking about power and suffering with little precedent in the ancient world. This paradox, strength emerging from weakness, ultimate truth found in apparent irrationality, echoes the dictum credo quia absurdum, "I believe it because it is absurd." This sentiment finds its deepest modern expression in Kierkegaard's view that faith requires a leap beyond reason. Yet it also edges uncomfortably close to George Costanza's line that something isn't a lie if you believe it. And a starkly apocalyptic interpretation of the New Testament is always near at hand. The Epistle to the Hebrews, for instance, makes Christianity's blood logic unsettlingly plain. With animal sacrifices at the temple ended, only a greater sacrifice, God's Son, can suffice. This doctrine is embedded in the Catholic Mass, where the Lamb of God represents not gentleness, but a creature slaughtered for the good of the world. This concept horrified critics like William Empson, who saw it as depicting a cosmos ruled by an irrational deity whose rage toward humanity can be placated only by his son's torture and death. That logic, however buried beneath more palatable readings, runs like a dark current throughout the text. Liberals reading the Bill of Rights look past the slave-holding hands that wrote it. Passionate Marxists regard the gulag as a deviation rather than a destination. And Christians, including the secularized kind, look past the demands of blood sacrifice and the specter of eternal punishment to focus on the extraordinary power of the common table, the promise that the last shall be first, and the idea that the rejected may yet be made royal. Kenneth Clark, in his still potent book Civilization, rightly singled out the Giotto frescoes in Padua, telling the Christ story from birth to murder to light restored, and Handel's Messiah as high points of what we mean by civilized life. It is difficult to take in such works without feeling that they express something close to divine inspiration. That Christianity spread across the world is an extraordinary fact of history. But we should resist the idea that it did so because of some inherent theological inevitability. The consequence of Constantine's adoption of the faith was less a grand design than a lucky break. Roman emperors mostly had the lifespans of gnats, and Constantine happened to avoid assassination. Christianity's rise should be no more astonishing than that of Mormonism, a Christian heresy with obviously fabricated origins. People seek faith, and faith, by its nature, demands the embrace of what reason resists. And the placid and ecumenical urge so appealing in more serene moments, can land differently in our own. Christianity, Catherine Nixie insists, largely invented religious intolerance and the persecution of dissenters. Hellenistic culture was imperfectly tolerant, the Christian one perfectly intolerant. Constantine, adopting the faith as an expansive gesture, was shocked by the vengeful fervor of his new adherents. Nor was Christian intolerance simply a response to persecution. The Notre Dame professor Candida Moss contends in The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom, published in 2013. Her book, as the title suggests, attempts to dismantle the idea of Christianity as a faith forged in suffering. She argues instead that it constructed a cult of victimhood while stamping out dissent and violently opposing any pluralism of thought. Christianity, often so powerful in causes of human equality, Martin Luther King Jr., after all, led the Southern Christian Leadership Conference until the day he died, has a bad record when it comes to authoritarianism, too often being it. Even now, we see among conservative intellectuals how once well-meaning Catholic communalism can collapse into Trumpite acquiescence. What is missing from the discussion today, perhaps, are the pagan opponents of early Christianity. From Celsus to the Emperor Julian, they responded at length to Christian claims. Yet their works are now almost entirely lost, known to us only in the fragments that their adversaries saw fit to preserve for the purpose of refutation. As Stephen Greenblatt reminded readers in his Lucretian adventure, The Swerve, some of these largely vanished thinkers, especially those at the Epicurean edge, seem to have already grasped what remains a core truth. The world is material and values are made by us, often shaped through poetic myths and transcendent metaphors. The humanism they championed was always plural. There are many plausible ways to live, but in its refusal of certainty, their humanism also produced enormous anxiety, and anxiety is always drawn toward the reassurance of authority. The authority always fails. The anxiety reasserts itself. A new amended authority emerges. In the interstices of such authority, the atoms we are made of will, by chance or by purpose, form and fix onto new patterns, some of them beautiful, some not, with the shapes of faith both grotesque to our cooler judgments and inspiring to our warmest imaginations. We, who are made of matter, must somehow find a way both to recognize this mystery and not to mind it too much. And now, also from the March 31st, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, from the Annals of Inquiry, Medical Benchmarks and the Myth of the Universal Patient. From growth charts to anemia thresholds, clinical standards assume a single human prototype. Why are we still using one-size-fits-all health metrics? By Manveer Singh. When my daughter was 10 and a half months old, she qualified as wasted, which UNICEF describes as the most immediate, visible, and life-threatening form of malnutrition. My wife and I have been trying hard to keep her weight up, and the classification felt like a pronouncement of failure. Her birth weight had been on the lower end of the scale, but nothing alarming, 6 pounds, 2 ounces. She appeared as a dot on a chart in which colored curves traced optimal growth, 15th percentile, we were told. She took well to breastfeeding, and within a month had jumped to the 20th percentile, then the 26th. We proudly anticipated that her numbers would steadily climb. Then she fell behind, again. At 4 months, she was in the 12th percentile. At 9 and a half, she was below the 5th. Our pediatrician was worried. Ease off the lentils and vegetable smoothies, we were warned. We needed to get more calories into our babe. Ghee, peanut butter, We were to drench her food in these and other fats and wash them down with breast milk and formula. And that's what we did. When we came back a month later, though, we learned that she had dropped further and crossed into wasted territory. Was this what malnutrition looked like? She seemed to be flourishing. She was happy, adventurous, and exuberantly social, babbling incessantly and forever engaging strangers with flirtatious stares. She had cheeks as plump as the juicy clementines that she loved to eat with full-fat yogurt. Although slow to hands and knees crawling, scooting was her preferred means of locomotion. She was hitting most of her other milestones. She was also growing longer and longer, shooting from the 12th percentile at birth to the 36th at 10 months. In adaptable how your unique body really works and why our biology unites us, published by Avery, Herman Ponser, an evolutionary anthropologist at Duke University, recounts facing a similar conundrum. While Ponser was visiting a semi-desert village in northern Kenya to study the Dasanak pastoralist, a German charity representative told him that the community was being devastated by malnutrition. Charity workers had plotted the heights and weights of Dasanak children on World Health Organization charts, the same ones our pediatrician used to monitor my daughter's growth, and determined that more than two-thirds of the kids were malnourished. As a result, families were enrolled in a nutrition program and provided with high-calorie, industrially processed supplements. Yet, as with my daughter, the numbers did not align with ordinary observation. Everywhere we went, children were running, playing, and laughing, Ponser writes. Kids being kids. They didn't seem low on energy, nor did they seem particularly short or stunted. He saw no other signs of chronic starvation, such as bloated bellies or reduced fertility among adult women. The kids were slim, but in the lanky way typical of so many East African pastoralists. When Ponser and his team tracked the growth of Dasanak children, they uncovered patterns that sharply diverged from the WHO curves. At around age 2, these kids gain height at rates seldom seen elsewhere in the world. At 5, they stand taller, on average, than well-fed kids in Europe and North America. At the same time, they put on weight more slowly, developing lean physiques that are optimal for heat dissipation. Where the German charity diagnosed deficiency, Ponsner saw adaptation. Adaptable offers an engrossing, richly informative exploration of human biological diversity. By revealing how our variable bodies respond to a wide range of environments, it challenges us to rethink universal health benchmarks. These standards inform everything from how we define malnutrition and micronutrient deficiencies to how we estimate the risks of growth abnormalities, metabolic disorders, and cardiovascular dysfunction. They drive global funding priorities, shape international aid programs, and inform social policies. They guide individual clinical assessments, like my daughter's, and underpin broad statistical claims. 17% of humans are zinc deficient. Nearly a quarter of Asian Pacific children are stunted. Yet these benchmarks rest on a monolithic image of human health, a prototypical human sapiens whose vulnerabilities remain unchanged across climates and genetic histories. We've entered the age of neurodiversity, precision medicine, and bioindividuality, but we still assume that malnutrition looks the same in Cologne as it does in rural Kenya. Is it time to move beyond the model of the universal patient? For decades, pediatricians relied on growth charts for infants and young toddlers, which were wildly and obviously flawed. The WHO had endorsed standards developed by the U.S. National Center for Health Statistics based on data from a single American community, Yellow Springs, Ohio. There were questions about their relevance for children elsewhere in the country, let alone the world. But when the WHO released the new child growth standards in 2006, it appeared that we at last had a truly global benchmark drawn from studies of children across 5 continents. The coordinating team recruited participants from 6 far-flung locations, Oslo, Norway, Muscat, Oman, Pelotas, Brazil, New Delhi, India, Accra, Ghana, and, as it happens, the city where I live, Davis, California. The researchers maintained strict inclusion criteria, tracking only breastfed children born to well-off, non-smoking mothers. The resulting charts gained remarkable traction. By April 2011, 125 countries had adopted them, and the United Nations treated them as the new gold standards. Implementation was costly, often requiring countries to overhaul child health records, retrain medical personnel, and acquire new measurement equipment. These standards seemed authoritative in part because of their vaunted universality. As the project coordinators wrote in 2006, the standards could be used to assess children everywhere, regardless of ethnicity, socioeconomic status, and type of feeding. The coordinators also noted a striking similarity in the data collected among the 6 sites, which, given the built-in ethnic or genetic variability, affirmed the standards' universal applicability. Yet how much variability was there really? The WHO did not publish detailed ethnicity information, but at the time the data were collected, most residents of Oslo, Pelotas, and Davis were of European ancestry. Africa, with more genetic diversity than any other continent, was characterized by a single site. Pacific Islanders, indigenous Americans, and most glaringly, East and Southeast Asians were not represented at all. The claim of striking similarity was also tenuous. The team based its claim on the fact that, at every age, the average height of children at each site was within 0.5 standard deviation of the overall average. But by that reasoning, as the Indian pediatrician Harshpal Singh Sachdev recently observed in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, 2 sites could differ by as much as 1 standard deviation and still be considered equivalent. That's like saying that the mean adult heights in Denmark and Taiwan exhibit striking similarity, despite differing by more than 6 centimeters. Among low-income families in urban India, Sachdev noted, ambitious interventions targeting health, sanitation, nutrition, and psychosocial support have failed to increase stature by 0.5 standard deviation, suggesting that differences among sites may reflect disparate physiological baselines. Beyond height, no cross-site comparisons have ever been published for other measurements, including weight for height, weight for age metrics, and head circumference. Nevertheless, these metrics are regularly used for clinical and cross-national purposes and treated as if they were universally applicable. When the WHO reports that nearly 1 in 6 African children is underweight, or when the Global Nutrition Report states that 45.4 million children under the age of 5 are wasted, public health policies are guided by untested assumptions. My wife and I didn't know any of this when our daughter was first flagged for being underweight. But we had suspicions that her size might not have been as atypical as the charts implied. My wife's family, like mine, immigrated from India. Asking around, we learned that many parents of South Asian ancestry had exceptionally small children. On Reddit forums, such as r/India and r/ABCDesis, we discovered parents worrying about the same issue. 2 of my wife's cousins had been born smaller than our daughter. It turned out that credible research corroborated our suspicions. A series of Stanford-led studies had analyzed millions of births in the U.S. and documented a dual paradox. U.S.-born women of Mexican parentage, despite having higher risk profiles than U.S.-born women of Indian ancestry, are less likely to have babies with low birth weights. That's one of the many inconsistencies pertaining to size and nutrition. Take the so-called South Asian enigma. India, Bangladesh, and Nepal exceed most sub-Saharan Africa countries on key health and development indicators. But their populations still fail to measure up, literally, to those in sub-Saharan Africa or the African diaspora. For instance, Haiti's infant mortality rate is almost twice that of India's, and its per capita GDP is 30% lower. Yet, only 6% of Haitian children are assessed as severely stunted, compared with 14% of Indian children. You find similar disparities between affluent nations in East Asia and those in Northern Europe. Japan and the Netherlands are among the wealthiest countries in the world, with first-rate health care and low disease burdens. But some 7% of Japanese children qualify as stunted, compared with only about 1% in the Netherlands. The obvious takeaway is that factors aside from living standards, including biological inheritance, are the reason that Dutch and Haitian kids tower over their Japanese and Nepali peers. Yet many researchers have been wary of considering the possibility. In their efforts to resolve the South Asia enigma, for example, they have been busily investigating the effects of open-air defecation, maternal nutrition, and a preference for firstborn sons on the subcontinent. A team of economists examined whether the number of low-weight infants in sub-Saharan Africa who die skews height statistics. According to Daniel Hruska, an anthropologist at Arizona State University, none of these theories explain away the discrepancies. Hruska has long had a personal interest in body measurements. I consider myself pretty healthy, but if you use BMI guidelines, I am obese. And I've always wondered, what does that mean for my health? He told me. The question inspired him to spend more than a decade dissecting anthropometric data, resulting in a slew of revealing findings. In research published in the 2010s, he confirmed that a single BMI cutoff for distinguishing normal from obese body weight overestimates obesity as defined by body fat in populations with stockier bodies, Pacific Islanders say, and underestimates it in leaner peoples, South Asians. What's more, patterns in slenderness, such as similarities between closely related groups and between children and adults in the same group, strongly suggest that genetics plays a major role. In 2016, Hruska and the anthropologist Craig Hadley at Emory University estimated that the standard BMI cutoff misses roughly half a billion overweight people, including some 250 million in South Asia alone. After studying obesity, Hruska turned his attention to height. In one of his most ambitious projects, published in 2020, he and his former student, Joseph Hackman, now at the University of Utah, analyzed measurements from 1.5 million children across 70 countries, using data on wealth, hygiene, nutrition, and infectious disease exposure. They calculated each country's basal height for age index, the starting height of children living under comparable environmental conditions. If the WHO had been right to assume that children's potential height is the same everywhere, basal height for age measurements should be consistent across populations. They weren't. For instance, the basal heights of children in India differ by more than a standard deviation from those of children in Haiti. Even when reared in identical environments, an Indian two-year-old would be expected to be 3 centimeters shorter than a Haitian two-year-old. When Hruska and Hackman recalculated rates of severe stunting based on these findings, the estimated prevalence in Haiti more than tripled, from 6% to 20%. Similarly, dramatic increases were observed in West and Central Africa. The reliance on growth charts, it seems, has hidden millions of severe stunting cases in parts of Africa. These calculations raise another troubling possibility. Estimates of stunting in other regions might be exaggerated, leading to ill-advised nutritional interventions. A 2021 study by Sachdev found that more than half of Indian children aged 5 to 19 classified as malnourished by WHO standards actually show biomarkers of obesity. Metabolically, they are even overnourished, Sachdev told me. Where pediatricians would normally recommend cutting back on high-calorie food for such children, here we are pushing it, he said. This blindness to human variation affects children in wealthy countries, too. Though the WHO charts are meant to spot abnormal growth, they regularly miss growth disorders in European children. It can't help that the charts for 5 to 19-year-olds still draw on decades-old data from the United States. In the Netherlands and Sweden, the WHO charts catch only about 70% of children over the age of 5 with growth hormone deficiency. Country-specific charts spot around 95%. In a 2016 study of 9 European nations, the WHO standards consistently failed to outperform local references, except in France, which hadn't updated its growth charts since 1979. So charts meant to protect children's health may be failing them across the globe, missing growth disorders in tall populations while pathologizing normal development in shorter ones. Parents in Mumbai, Manila, and Minneapolis alike must navigate a medical system built on standards that don't reflect their children's physiological realities. Some children who need care may be overlooked. Others are subjected to unnecessary and potentially harmful interventions. Our differences are obvious, even on the surface, Ponser observed in Adaptable. Why should our insides be any less diverse? It's a reasonable question. We regularly confront the fact that different environments have the power to change us. We know that people who train at high altitudes developed greater aerobic capacity and that populations long exposed to more UV radiation develop darker skin. Ponser catalogs a great many such examples, from East African hunter-gatherers whose lifestyle shielded them from cardiovascular disease to Southeast Asian sea nomads with genetic adaptations that let them spend hours a day underwater. Yet international organizations continue to operate on the assumption of a universal human physiology, one that in practice corresponds strikingly with Euro-American models. In January, we celebrated our daughter's first birthday. For reasons of happenstance, we were seeing a new pediatrician for her 12-month visit. We felt confident. We had ramped up feeding efforts, watching with satisfaction as our daughter's thighs plumped and her round belly spilled over the waistband of her diaper. Admittedly, every previous visit to the pediatrician's office had begun with the same sense of achievement, only to be deflated by troubling percentiles. But this time, she looked particularly pudgy. 17, my wife whispered, stealing my guess. 16 pounds, 7 ounces, the nurse read, squinting at the scale. Not bad, I thought. When the pediatrician entered, he handed us printouts of familiar curves, each marked with a dot representing our daughter, 6th percentile for both weight for age and weight for height. He asked how these numbers compared with her previous measurements. As we answered him, he stared at the charts, seemingly wrestling with the severity of the situation. Then he said that he was referring us to a dietitian. Despite ordering a weight check in 6 weeks and several blood tests, though, he did not appear to be visibly troubled. It was as if he, like us, saw two versions of our daughter, the one sitting before him, gleeful and energetic, and the other on the chart, abstractly a cause for concern. Not knowing which to trust, he deferred the verdict to someone else. Such uncertainty is inherent to medical inference. A heavy baby might just be big-boned, a small one slim but robust. Yet the reliance on universal benchmarks has widened the disconnect between bodies and their measurements. Resistant to acknowledging population differences, these standards often flag healthy bodies as worrisome and look past malnourished ones. As a result, hundreds of millions of people, often in the poorest countries, are mislabeled, while tools like the WHO's growth standards, stretched to fit all of humanity, prove less effective than local alternatives. Paradoxically, these efforts sometimes undermine their own goals, concealing and at times exacerbating the afflictions of the most vulnerable. In mid-February, we met virtually with the dietitian. She asked about our feeding routine, which foods, when, how much breastfeeding, and watched as our daughter clambered from my wife's lap onto the table, reaching for the computer. The dietitian didn't refer us to another specialist or dwell on percentiles. Instead, she assured us that our daughter was okay. Petite, yes, but holding her own. Besides, she confirmed, many Indian children tend to be smaller. Still, she advised us to keep feeding her well and often, to add butter and the like whenever we could, to stay vigilant. Maybe in a decade, the one-size-fits-all curves will give way to standards that recognize the different shapes of different populations, and the advice will shift to match. But for now, we live in the space between two realities, the numbers on a spreadsheet and the child in our arms. Next, a poem from the March 31, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, Arms, by Richie Hoffman. Even far from home, we felt safe. We walked around the ruins, bodies of men whose heads and privates were smashed off. None of the statues had arms. We heard about the boy who drowned while swimming with a dolphin. Later, we were by the pool. My father read a magazine. I could see pictures in his sunglasses when he turned a page. On the island where boys drown, I remember his arms pulling me from the water. An archaeologist in a bathing suit. The night was humid. The stone he put me down on, warm. It would have been a catastrophe for my father, but it would not have changed a thing in the world. I was a boy who drowned, the old women would say, drawn from the water by his father's arms. The tide came in. You wouldn't have known there was ever a beach. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.